We are now in session. This is the Senate Education Committee. It's April 14, 2015. It's 3:31 p.m. We do have a quorum. With us is Senator Huggins, Senator Stevens, Senator Gardner just stepped out momentarily, and Senator Giesel is chairing a resource meeting and probably will not be here. Today, we're going to be hearing three bills, SB 37, sexual assault, sexual abuse, assault prevention programs, SB 84, language immersion schools, teacher certification, Senate Bill 102, unfunded education mandates, training teachers. Senate Bill 37 is going to be up first, and again, I have to apologize to the folks that wanted to testify the last two meetings. We had very long meetings as a result of another bill that was being heard, but first up is SB 37. And Lauren, are you going to be the one? Come on up, get yourself ready. And then, if you would, state your name for the record, begin your testimony, give us an overview of the bill, any changes or any points you want us to focus on.
Great. Thank you. For the record, Lauren Rasmussen, staff to Senator McGuire. I apologize, Senator McGuire is currently in another committee, otherwise she would be here at this time. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Education Committee, Senate Bill 37 is the Alaska Safe Children's Act, and if you'd like, I can go over the main points of this bill again to refresh your memories. So, let me get my stuff here.
You can give us an overview and then go ahead and hit the points.
So, Senate Bill 37 is, like I said, known as the Alaska Safe Children's Act. It's an important piece of legislation that will require school districts to set up a policy for policy and training program for staff, students, and parents on the topic of sexual assault and teen dating violence. The Alaska Safe Children's Act will combat child abuse and teen dating violence and add volunteer athletic coaches to the existing mandatory reporting statute. This bill also repeals requirements for school districts to pay for physical examinations. Excuse me. And it repeals the requirement that certificated preschool teachers must be fingerprinted and background checked a second time after being hired. This bill will empower children, parents, and teachers by providing a structure for pulling the stories of abuse out of the shadows and demonstrating to future generations that every child has a voice. In a state as resource rich as ours, it is time we turn our focus on our most precious resource, our children. Sorry, a little nervous.
Fine, you're
doing good. Okay. So, I have answers to some of the questions that were raised at the last committee, at the last hearing of this bill, if you would like me to address some of those.
If you want to go over the questions, and yes, please.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, you asked what the procedure is for teachers or principals coming to teach in Alaska from out of state who may have a criminal or suspicious history. According to the Department of Education, a person still would need to apply for an initial license in Alaska, which will require a fingerprint card and a completed background check through the Department of Public Safety and the National Crime Information Center. Senator Huggins, you also asked, through the chair, if we have looked into the number of rape kits collected and tested. Senator McGuire recognizes that this is a very important topic to explore and plans on working on this important issue through the interim. And through the chair, Senator Huggins, your final question was, if there were any college programs that educate on this topic, while this bill only pertains to grades K through 12, we have looked at schools around the state and found that there are a number of classes offered at both the University of Alaska Anchorage and University of Alaska Fairbanks, for example, the Department of Psychology and Department of Human Services offer classes pertaining to abuse and other things included in this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And then last question that I wanted to address was from Senator Gardner. In response to your question on the mandatory reporters training, and for the volunteer athletic coaches, you're correct in that the statute only requires the training be completed within the first 6 months of hire, which could potentially be an issue when trying to train these volunteer athletic coaches who are seasonal, just, you know, maybe a summertime kind of thing. And so Senator McGuire believes that this is a very valid concern for us to continue looking into, and she thanks the members for all of the questions that were posed.
Do we have any questions for Lauren at this point? Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. this would take out the issue of repealing a certificate of preschool teachers being fingerprinted and background checked a second time. So I understand that, but what is it? Why are we doing it twice? Is there a rationale behind that? Why does that even occur?
It's through the chair, Senator Stevens. I don't have a perfect answer for you right now. I can get back to you on that.
It's okay. We do have members of our employees of the Department of Education. Is there anyone there that would like to answer that question? Please come forward if you could help out and state your name for the record.
Susan McCauley, Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the Department of Education and Early Development. There are two separate systems that are set up for what might seem like the same purpose, but they're in fact two different purposes. The system established by the Department of Education is for the purpose of certification of teachers. The system established by Health and Social Services, to which they could probably speak better than I, is required when one obtains a position teaching in a preschool facility. That does, however, create a situation because of those two separate systems whereby a certificated preschool teacher is currently required to be fingerprinted twice, once for the Department of Education for the purposes of obtaining certification, and once by Health and Social Services for the purpose of being employed in a preschool facility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And do you support this repeal of having it done twice, the department?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, from a perspective of reducing a burden potentially on an individual, that is understandable, but one should note that the systems do two different things. The Health and Social Services database into which those fingerprinting records are entered is a 24/7 real-time check in an ongoing manner on criminal activity. The system that is maintained by the Department of Education is a check only upon initial certification. So the language in Section 2 requires the department to establish a procedure for sending over fingerprinting records for the purpose of satisfying Health and Social Services requirements. What is unclear, though, is whether or not that procedure would result in those records being entered into a real-time ongoing check, as is currently the case. So I think it is probably worth further inquiry with Health and Social Services as to whether providing them with the fingerprinting results in the records for those individuals, certificated preschool teachers, no longer being in that 24/7 system that's checking. I don't, through the chair, believe that is what's intended. What's intended is to reduce what's perceived as a duplicate requirement, when in fact they are two somewhat different requirements.
But it is duplicative for the school district. But for the individual, they have to send out to two different departments.
Chair Dunleavy, the requirements, the current requirements for certificated preschool teachers do require being fingerprinted twice, yes.
So this bill would let take it down to one, and the departments are trying to figure out how to make that happen.
Chair Dunleavy, that's correct. In terms of Section 2 and what would be the department's responsibility for forwarding those fingerprinting records, that is something the department can
right.
do.
And I think it's a good move. Just one of the comments I've gotten from some educators is, if we send it to the state, can't they share between departments? Why do we have to theoretically, one individual said to me, what happens if four departments wanted fingerprints? Does that mean we have to send four different sets, or can they use the set one set that we send there? So anyway, I appreciate your efforts at working interdepartmentally to reduce the mandates on our fine, hardworking educators. Thank you, Doctor. Question?
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman? Who pays the cost? Does the individual teacher, does the department?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the individual pays the cost of those fingerprinting.
And how much is that, do you know?
I don't, I'm sorry.
You nice to know that amount. And
yeah, about $75.
Mm-hmm.
So they send out fingerprints for each hand. It's twice. Anyway, I'm sorry. Senator Gardner.
I'd just like to clarify for Senator Stevens and other members that this applies to only 100 teachers. There's only about 100 certificated preschool teachers in the state. But we'd worked on this and were unable to ascertain whether there had been any benefit whatsoever since the program's inception. In other words, was one person who, based on their criminal records after they had been hired, should this 24/7 scanning fingerprints had been determined to be unfit or inappropriate as a certificated preschool teacher. So that was one of my concerns. You know, we've done this for however long it is, and has there been any benefit to anybody at all? We couldn't find a single case, and maybe there has been, but we couldn't find it. So, and then the other thing is, if it's so important to do it for preschool teachers, why isn't it important for kindergarten teachers or first grade teachers or so on? Where do you draw the line? I'm not convinced that there's any great value to doing it for 100, having it in statute for 100 pre-K teachers, but that's another issue.
So the uniform kindergarten 1, 2, 3, you're just saying the real time aspect.
The real time, right. And they do it for pre-K also, but why is it important to do it every day for them? I don't know.
Thank you. Any additional questions for Dr. McCauley at this point? Well, Senator?
Yeah, Dr. McCauley, thanks. Good to see you. You know, I actually, seat of the pants, have come to the conclusion that there may be, for students, young people, pupils, that there's potentially a greater danger for them, threat for them, for people that for whatever reasons get shuffled on by the system there because they don't have a record, but they got shuffled on because it didn't have the evidence, whatever the case may be, and they transfer from Arizona to Alaska. But if you went and you talked to the local people, they go, wow, I can't believe, but they can't share it with you because of the liability. Am I seat of the pants all messed up or not?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'm not sure I understand.
I'll say it plain English. Okay. I'm a teacher in Arizona, mm-hmm. and I do something there that, quite frankly, can't be proven that makes me a felon or some other convicted person, but I get, well, if you just move on, right? And I say, okay, I resign. And then I move to Alaska, and then I repeat that same behavior here. Mm-hmm. Am I misplaced in my concerns or not?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, if the behavior that occurred previously results in the individuals having any sort of a criminal record, that would be picked up upon initial certification. I'm guessing that might not be what you're referring to. You're talking about potentially other behaviors that don't rise to the level of an individual having a criminal record. One would hope that hiring procedures would vet that information through traditional reference checks and those sorts of things. But from a formal perspective of what the certification process does, it's going to pick up criminal activities that are a matter of public record.
Any additional questions for Dr. McCauley at this moment? Thank you. Lauren, I have a question. There's no fiscal note, is that correct?
With the...
is there a fiscal note? Did it pick up a fiscal note?
With the first version that was introduced, no. I haven't seen a new fiscal note come through for the committee substitute.
Okay. Any questions for Lauren? Lauren, because we have a number of folks that wish to testify. And we can always bring Lauren back up. Thank you. So first to testify would be Jordan Marshall. Jordan, can you come forward, please, state your name for the record, who you're with, and we have a number of folks that wish to testify, and we have three bills, so I'm going to limit this to 2 minutes starting out, okay? So, Jordan, when you're ready, please begin.
Senator Dunleavy, members of the committee, my name is Jordan Marshall. I'm External Affairs Manager at Rasmussen Foundation, R-A-S-M-U-S-O-N. Rasmussen Foundation has a long-standing history of supporting organizations and programs designed to prevent child abuse and neglect. If this law were to pass, Rasmussen Foundation would most certainly entertain a grant application to develop curriculum and training. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Any questions for Jordan? Yes, Senator.
There is a lot of curriculum available, but I think the biggest concern for school districts is a webinar. And at one point, the department suggested they might be able to do that, but in light of their anticipated budget, that might be harder. So are you anticipating being able to help produce a webinar?
We would absolutely entertain a grant application to develop curriculum and training, and if that were to be in the form of a webinar, I'm sure that would
thank you.
That would be well received.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Next individual, I believe, is online. Amy Ballenbach, are you online from Homer?
I'm online from Homer, but I'm a little bit confused about the changes in the bill. I mean, I agreed with the earlier version of Aaron's law. This one is a little more complicated and seems to be relating to teachers more than to other things. So I guess I would just say that I think it's important for schools to educate children about sexual predators and other dangers, but I haven't examined, I don't quite understand how this relates to the former bill and et cetera. So I think it's really important to have sex education about sexual assault.
Thank you very much. Kate Finn, are you online from Anchor Point?
Yes, I am. Actually, I'm in the LIO of Homer.
Okay. Could you begin state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please, for about 2 minutes?
Sure. Okay. My name is Kate Finn. I live in Anchor Point. I have 38 years of working as a nurse in the state of Alaska, and five of those are as a sexual assault nurse examiner. I assume we're working on the same copy. I have a work draft dated April 1st, 15. Is that correct? Is that what everybody's working with?
We are working on a work draft that should say 29LS0488/...
November
and 4115, yes.
Okay, that's great. Okay, in that case, there are many things about this bill that I really applaud. And one of the things that I'm seeing in this one that I don't remember seeing in what I thought was a previous version is that it appears that parents have the opportunity, certainly, to have their children not attend any of the sessions that the parents don't want them to attend. Okay, if that's what needs to happen, that's what needs to happen. But it appears to be an opt-out system, which I really like, versus an opt-in system. So am I reading this bill correctly, that if parents would choose to have their children not participate in the curriculum, that it's an opt-out deal. Is that correct?
Well, Ms. Finn, we're really not set up for a question and answer period. We're just hoping that you would give us your thoughts on the bill.
Well, as I read the bill, it appears to be an opt-out system, and if that's correct, if I'm reading it right, then I applaud that. I think an opt-in system is unworkable and would never do what a curriculum for healthy relationships, prevention of sexual assault, recognition of predator actions, it would not work in an opt-in. But in an opt-out situation, I think that's very good. So if I'm reading it correctly, I would urge you to pass this bill.
Okay. Kate, we're past the 2 minutes. Can you wrap up, please? Because we do have a large number of folks that wish to testify.
That's fine. That's really my primary point.
Okay.
That was my primary point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sandra Gareth, are you online?
I am.
Please begin your testimony for about 2 minutes. State your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Sandra Garrity, and I also am a resident of Homer. I also am a retired RN and have seen some of these victims. But I would like to say that I'd like to see this bill mandatory. And part of the reason for that, I will just say quickly, I came from a family of four girls. And we have our grandchildren and some great-grandchildren, and in our small circle, we have four victims, sexually abused victims. We're a middle-class family. We're a well-educated family. And even back then, even with my professional background, I did not understand all of the extent of this. But seeing the family members, and this is a lifetime situation that they're living with once that they've been abused, and so I don't think they can get enough education, I guess is what I'm saying here, and that includes the parents, that includes the public and the children, and I would like to see it mandatory and that they get this every year so that there are new things that we learn in this, and so I would support the bill in that favor. I think it's a very necessary bill.
Thank you very much. Next we have Karen Benson. Oh, excuse me, I guess she's online for questions, and so isn't Mary Bell. So let's go to Mike Coons. Mike Coons, are you online?
This is Mike Coons. You have in your packet my original statement. My name is Mike Coons. I'm from Palmer. I'm speaking for myself. I'm a retired paramedic, and I want to relate my experience as a paramedic to SB 37. I was a volunteer paramedic in Ohio and here in Alaska. All child abuse and child abuse, sexual abuse, were seen in Ohio. The multiple abuse situations I saw, the actions of OCS were less than stellar. Reporting was met with attacks on me. Not one of those cases were ever resolved what I saw and witnessed. The one case of sexual abuse that I saw, I had to up-channel to the number two person in that county to get any recognition. I had no interaction of Alaska OCS. Yet from testimony last month at the Westboro Town Hall meeting, it was readily apparent that OCS is a huge problem. A parent that takes a child to the ER that falls off a swing or has an accident are immediately attacked by OCS. But a quote-unquote mother that feeds Quaaludes to a three-year-old or leaves an 18-month-old out in the yard overnight, nothing happens to him. Yes, we need people to pick up on sexual abuse as well as neglect and other abuses. My concern is, will OCS do their job, or will those reports get the same treatment? Will the alleged person who is being accused be ran through the ringer where there isn't any evidence after investigation, while the real abusers are free to continue on? I'm asking these questions because I've seen the damage done by OCS both sides. The other issue is domestic violence. As was stated by the father of the young lady killed by her boyfriend, her friends knew abuse was going on, yet nobody told the teacher or the parents until after she was tragically killed. He was wrong, but internalized it and didn't ask for help. As a paramedic, I've seen time and again DV. This is a problem that is mind-boggling. The reasons that victims act the way they do are still not understood by professionals in the law enforcement and medical communities. Will SB 37 change what's going on? I truly hope so. But we'll not make any bets on success.
Mike, can you please wrap up? Because we just ran past the 2 minutes, please.
Right. Last sentence. Do we need to keep trying? Yes, of course we do. I support this bill, but all must understand what the realities are.
Thank you very much. Tanya Zamora Bay, are you online?
Yes, I am, sir.
Please begin your testimony. Identify who you are and who you're with, if anyone, and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen of the state, my name is Tanya, and I'm currently an advocate with STAR, Standing Together Against Rape, here in Anchorage. I am speaking to you today in support of passing Senate Bill 37, Alaska Safety Children's Act. Alaska is currently sitting four times the national average in child sexual abuse. That number only represents reported disclosures. In the reported disclosures, 95% of the time, the child knows the offender. Passing this bill would ensure that our children are given the resources and knowledge to defend themselves. The material taught would be in a language they understand and can use. We spend millions of dollars putting a band-aid on this issue. Putting more police on the streets will not impact a crime that happens all too much within the safety circle of our children. Giving our children the knowledge and confidence will be the root of fighting back on child sexual abuse. We, as Alaskans, are saying enough is enough. No more turning a blind eye and staying silent. Staying silent and not keeping our community informed is what allows the abuse to continue. In my line of work, I have heard far too many times from children, I did not want to tell because I was protecting my family. It is our job as adults in this community to protect, not a 5 or 6 year old child. So I ask you to pass Senate Bill 37 to protect all of our children of Alaska. And if I have time left over, so I would just like to share that recently here in Anchorage, we received a phone call from a mother about her young son who heard actually one of our commercials for a fundraiser we're getting ready to do. And her son was able to identify just off of a radio commercial when hearing our name. He was able to speak to what he learned in school from us coming into his school and giving a presentation on personal safety and personal boundaries. So if a young child can make that connection off of a radio commercial, imagine what they understand and actually listen to during those presentations.
Thank you. You finished right at 2 minutes, and I appreciate the content of your testimony. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Next individual is Lynn Sturr. Are you online, Lynn?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Please state your name for the record. Begin your testimony. If you have an association you wish to also identify, and you have 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Lynn Stewart, and I'm here in Anchorage, and I'm representing myself and the state of Alaska, actually. First of all, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to express my strong support for SB 37, the Alaska Safe Children's Act. As we've already heard, and as we know, Alaska has some of the highest statistics for sexual abuse and assault in our nation, along with some of the highest rates of domestic violence, and this includes teen dating violence, which is part of this bill that's being presented. Current statistics from the U.S. Department of Justice, it states that 3 teens will experience some kind of abuse in their romantic relationships. And according to the 2013 data from the Alaska Dashboard, physical teen dating violence for high school students in Alaska is 30% higher than the national average. So again, I strongly support educating our youth in grades K through 12, both on sexual abuse and violence and teen dating violence. I agree with other comments that have been made that this is something I think that needs to be repeated yearly as mandated in our schools and provided as age appropriate. Obviously, as our children get older and begin dating, there's different information that they need to have to make good choices for themselves. I think now is the time to talk about it. It's time to educate our community, our school administrators and teachers and parents about it, and most importantly, it's time to educate our youth. I've done a lot of research on the Lindsay Ann Burke Act, which was passed in 2007, and this mandated Rhode Island school districts to establish a teen dating violence policy and education curriculum. And 20 other states have since adopted similar policies. In 2008, the National Association of Attorney Generals also passed a resolution supporting teen dating violence education in all schools. One of the things that I read while on this website, labmf.org, and I encourage others to take a look, that it states, prevention is the safest, least expensive, and most proven way to address every public health epidemic, including teen dating violence.
Lynn, if you can wrap it up, that would be great.
Yep. And I'll just say that the goal of dating violence prevention is to stop incidents before they happen or worsen and avoid the injuries, punishments, and fear that lie in the wake of abuse. So again, I strongly support this bill, and I would appreciate you keeping moving it forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have online Robin Smith. Are you there? Robin Smith?
Hi, they didn't have the... Sorry, they didn't have the mic turned on yet.
Okay. So go ahead and identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, please.
My name is Robin Smith. I urge, and I thank you for letting me testify today, I urge you to support SB 37. We need programs in our public schools for awareness and prevention of sexual abuse and sexual assault. As you know, our state has a very serious problem with sexual assault and sexual violence. Children with a prior history of sexual victimization are extremely likely to be re-victimized. Some research estimates this risk to be more than 10 times greater to those children who have been sexually abused. The result is that girls are more likely to be sexually trafficked in the future. Statistics show approximately 80% of prostitutes were sexually abused as children. It is a violation of a child's very nature, which is to be vulnerable, curious, trusting, and dependent. Because trickery, manipulation, deceit, coercion, secrecy, threats, play, or bribery are part of a child's sexual abuse, a disruption to the child's normal development can occur and increase the risk of problems in childhood and adult life. Consequences of child abuse are low self-esteem, self-hatred, depression, and guilt. Success in school can be difficult. Sexual abuse costs Alaska money every day. Self-medication because of abuse can lead to alcohol or drugs. These lead to a myriad of problems, including teen pregnancy, failed careers, poverty, multiple partners, creating an environment for more increased risk of sexual abuse. These problems tax our healthcare, educational, judicial, police, and prison systems. According to the Child Welfare League of America, Alaska is consistently rated in the 5 worst states for child abuse. For every 1,000 children in Alaska, 42.2 were victims of abuse. That means that every year, approximately 8,000 children in Alaska are physically or sexually abused. This only represents reported cases that result in substantiation or indication of abuse.
Robin, could you wrap up, please? We've gone beyond 2 minutes. Could you wrap it up, please?
I am. Thank you. Prevention is cheaper than paying for consequences. This bill makes fiscal sense. Prevent major expenses later by educating children now. Please support and pass this bill. And by the way, I'm a volunteer for Planned Parenthood, too.
Thank you. Next, do we have Chelsea Morrison? Is it Chelsea Morrison or Chelsea Morrison Health?
It's Morrison Heath.
Heath, okay. Please identify yourself for the record if you're with some outfit and then or your association and begin your testimony, please. Thank you.
All right, thank you. My name is Chelsea Morrison Heath. I am a community educator with STAR, Standing Together Against Rape, here in Anchorage. I want to thank you for giving me time to testify today, and I strongly urge you to support SB 37. We know that Alaska, as you've already heard today, that Alaska has some of the highest rates of child abuse and child sexual abuse in the nation. We also have some of the highest rates of teen dating violence. So this kind of legislation, it alone won't solve the problem, right? We can't pass laws and expect that it'll fix the problem magically, but we do know that if we can increase the number of supportive adults in our community, having their lives, if we can make sure that all of these teachers and other supportive adults who are already in school, already interacting with our youth every single day, they are ready to respond to disclosures, they're ready to recognize warning signs, and they know what to do, because the children in our community, they have the right to be safe. As part of my job, I get to go into schools all over Anchorage and talk to youth about child sexual abuse, about sexual assault, dating violence, and the youth in our community are eager for this information. They want this information because so many of them have already been impacted. So many of them already know somebody who's been in an abusive relationship, who has been sexually abused, and they want to know what they can do. And so this bill, it creates that space. And so I respectfully urge you to move this bill forward.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Cindy and Butch Moore from Big Lake. Are you online?
Yes, this is Cindy Moore.
Okay, please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Cindy Moore, and I'm the mother of Brianna Moore, who was murdered on June 26, 2014, by her boyfriend. And I testified before on SB 37, and I know that during public testimony, there's a lot of facts and figures and statistics, you know, that cannot be verified. So I wanted to give you some information from a very trusted organization that you're familiar with. And as legislators, you're all members. And Speaker of the House, Mike Chenault, is an executive committee member. And that is the National Conference of State Legislators. And their purpose, of course, is to help states by giving them the tools, information, and resources to craft best solutions to difficult problems. And discussing injury prevention legislation, they say they work in cooperation with the Centers for Disease Control Prevention, and as legislators, they keep you up to date in real-time information about injury prevention legislation that has been introduced in the all 50 states. What they say is that nearly 75% of teens dated or went out with someone in the previous year. Of those teens, at least 10% of the adolescents say they have been a victim of physical violence at least once in the previous 12 months. And according to the CDC, in that same survey, 10% reported that they had experienced sexual dating violence at least once in the previous 12 months. So that is basically 20% yearly that have had physical and sexual dating violence. They say that the mental and physical health consequences can extend into adulthood, and unhealthy relationships in adolescence can also create a cycle of abusive relationships. The mental and physical health consequences can extend into adulthood, and unhealthy relationships in adolescence can also create a cycle of abusive relationships. They say that prevention incentives include early education about safe dating practices. They say that adolescence is a window of opportunity for prevention, and that policymakers play a critical role in preventing teen dating violence. They say that at least 19 states have laws that urge or require school boards to develop curriculum on teen dating violence. I think that's actually currently 21. And they give options for policymakers, and their number one option was support evidence-based programs in schools and communities such as Safe Dates and 4th R that are proven to prevent and intervene in violent teen dating relationships. Programs are more likely to lower the incidence of teen dating violence when science informs their curricula. So I'm asking this committee to move this forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Butch Moore, do you wish to testify as well?
Yes, please.
Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Senator Dunleavy and Senate Education Committee, my name is Butch Moore. Cindy and I have raised three girls in Alaska, and sadly, up until about less than a year ago, we were one of the 81% of parents nationwide who do not believe that teen dating violence is a problem or are not even aware of it. It wasn't until after my daughter was killed by her boyfriend that four of her friends all told me the same thing. We all knew what was going on. We saw her three or four times with black eyes, and they said we didn't know what to do. And so I've put forward to you in an email prior to the prior meeting, if you can make an amendment to add what to do in the education, because that's the biggest stumbling block that I think victims and friends come across. I wish that 10 or 20 years ago someone was doing what we're doing today and my daughter would have had this education along with her classmates and her boyfriend and her coworkers and friends. This may not have happened. Specifically, I'd like to quote Senator Gary Stevens in the last meeting regarding the opt-out. He said, and I quote, "Who would not want their child to receive this education? And only if someone was abusing their own child would they opt out." I think it's very important that this education is mandatory. We've learned it's taken many years, but 1965, they instituted seatbelts. Seatbelts saved approximately 50% of the lives in a major accident. So I don't think that anyone would advocate not using a seatbelt or a child safety seat. And I just want to ask you to move this through your committee, pass it along. If we're talking about 20% of all teens who are dating grades 7 through 12 are either being sexually assaulted or physically abused, how many children are in the schools in Alaska, grades 7 through 12, coming up this next school year, 2015 to 16, 20% of them will be assaulted or abused? We need this education, and the Rasmussen Foundation has been gracious enough to come forward with a grant. So please pass this forward and move it on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We do have one more individual online, and that's Ken Landfield from Homer. Ken, can you identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, and then we're going to go to the audience here at the committee meeting.
Good afternoon. My name is Ken Landfield. I live in Homer. It seems to me that if we can agree that child sexual abuse is a real issue in Alaska, then it should be clear that education and training on awareness and prevention are at the very least cost-effective and something that we should all take very, very seriously. And so I urge you to pass SB 37. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone here in Juneau, in the audience, that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, at this time we're going to put the bill off to the side. We're going to hear the next bill on the docket. And I'll be speaking with the committee here and bill sponsor. So with that, let's go to SB 84, Language Immersion Schools, Teacher Certification. This is a bill by Senator Donnie Olson, and I believe we have one of Senator Olson's staff testifying today. If you can come forward, please, Jackie. You're going to state your name for the record, the office that you're with, and if you can, give us an overview of SB 84. This is the first hearing of this bill. It's being introduced today. And when you're ready to go, pull the mic close to you and begin.
Okay. Good afternoon, committee members and Chair Dunleavy. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Boyer, and I'm an intern for Senator Olson. Before you is the bill SB 84, and the intent of this bill is to set up a special category for language immersion charter schools across the state to produce bilingual students or vitalize in endangered languages. In today's market, students need more than just an understanding of their 3 R's to ensure success. Senator Olson believes having students learn an additional language can help bulk up their resume to prepare them for the job market. Not only will additional language fluency help make students' resumes look better, it changes the thought process of the brain to help them think differently. It helps develop metalinguistic awareness, word decoding, and phonological awareness. Additionally, students will achieve academically regardless of the second language being learned, and then will often do better than their monolingual peers. You can find more examples of the benefits of immersion education in your packets. In Alaska, some of the most prominent and successful immersion education models include Frontieris, Rukushula, and Niketshut. This bill is aimed to help aid these programs. A common barrier for immersion schools is finding certified teachers who know the language well enough to conduct a classroom entirely in the second language and can teach in the immersion environment. So what else this bill would do would allow people who are proficient in the language to be part of the school's academic policy committee. In current statutes, only school employees, teachers, and parents can be a part of. And then teachers can get certified through 3 different means. They can have a traditional teacher certificate as well as an immersion endorsement. The immersion endorsement is especially important because some other schools have faced some troubles keeping teachers because they're unprepared for the immersion environment.
Yeah, I know. You're supposed to be talking with the committee. I think I'm okay.
Teachers can also get certified by having a limited language certificate. It's current. It's similar to the Type N certificates. And then we believe this is especially important to get the few people out there that are fluent in the language but don't meet all the qualifications for a regular teacher certificate. A person can also get certified through the local tribe. Other states like Arizona, Wisconsin, and California have already passed legislation similar to get tribes more involved with the schools. And then lastly, it lets state students take benchmark tests in the language of instruction. And if you look at the fiscal note associated with the bill, it doesn't reflect the intent of the bill. We did not want the department to translate standardized tests into all these different languages. We need to clarify that we wanted students to be able to test in the language if it is already available. And then with that, Senator Olson's office is still looking for feedback and ways of improving this bill. And thank you for hearing it.
Thank you, Jackie. Is this your first time presenting the bill?
Yes.
You did great. There may be a couple questions from some of the senators, and it's always good when you introduce a bill for the first time. It gives us time to think about it. We'll set the bill aside here when we're done, but it'll give us time to take a look at it, study it, ask some questions, and then the next time that the bill is brought up, we will understand it even more. Are there any questions for Jackie from members of the committee, Senator?
Thank you, Jackie. I have a question that you might want to answer when we bring it up the next time. Mm-hmm. But charter schools have a specific way of coming into being. They're sort of ideally homegrown by a, you know, group of parents or teachers or community members or any combination that say this is what we want to do. And they operate under a charter from their district, and they're sort of exempt from possibly the curriculum or different aspects of what schools normally do. Mm-hmm. There are also alternative schools, and I think the alternative schools in Anchorage, and I could be wrong, but at least some of the language immersion programs are alternative schools and not charter schools. Mm-hmm. So the alternative school is set up by the district rather than by this community force. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason that this bill envisions being a charter school as opposed to just an alternative school?
I get back to you on that.
Okay. It seems to me it might be easier to, in some communities at least, to have it led by the district to help things set up. But maybe Senator Olson had a specific reason. Okay.
So just a comment. That's a very good question. Your charter schools, they basically coalesce around a mission with an APC. I know you know this. And your magnet schools or your special mission schools, they don't necessarily need that. It's a good question. It's just something for us to think about. I just have one. This bill would not be limited to just native speaking charter schools, correct? It would be any type of language immersion charter school.
Yeah, it would be. It's for all languages.
Okay. Well, thank you. Any additional questions for Jackie at this point? I think what we'll do, Jackie, we'll set the bill aside. Like I said, it gives us time to think about it and ask some more questions. Yes. So before we do that, we do have, we're going to open up public testimony. We do have two folks online. You can stay there if you wish. We have two folks online that would like to testify. Dr. Dina Perano from MATSU, are you online?
Senator.
Doctor, we hear you loud and clear. Can you identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, please?
Hi, my name is Dina Paramo. I'm the superintendent of the MATSU Borough School District, and good afternoon, Chairman Dunleavy, Vice Chair Huggins, and Senators Stevens and Gardner. I'm testifying today as a superintendent, of course, in support of Senate Bill 84, an act relating to language immersion charter schools, teacher certification, and standards-based assessments in language immersion charter schools and programs. As a district who highly values choice in educational programs and delivery, this bill provides for specific certification and recognition of teachers at language immersion charter schools. Matsu Borough School District has a Russian language immersion neighborhood school and a Spanish language charter school. Immersion programs are unique in that they require educators to have language fluency in addition to content knowledge and teacher preparation. Senate Bill 84 formally recognizes through certification and those components of a successful immersion teacher and provides additional flexibility for school districts to hire non-traditional teachers who have the necessary language skills. Similar to Type M certificate that currently exists for career and technical education, this certificate values not only the preparation of teachers, but provides for the recognition of fluency in the language for which the immersion is grounded. It is the district for whom the applicant of the certificate will be hired and will teach, makes the request. While MATSU's first priority is always to secure fully certified teachers, there's not always a sufficient candidate pool in these specialized areas. Senate Bill 84 will allow school districts the flexibility needed to provide the best instructors for their courses and schools. Senate Bill 84 additionally benefits school districts in the statutory purposes for retaining staff during times of shortage, which is an important consideration for the long-term maintenance of a choice program. Finally, summary, Matsu Borough School District understanding of Senate Bill 84 is that an effective date for transitioning to this new certificate for language immersion charter school would allow ample time to communicate to our employees for which the certificate applies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question, Senator Stevens?
I'm sorry, quick question. Madam Superintendent, hire now non-certificate teachers?
Through the chair, we are able to hire Type M certificate teachers. So those, mainly they're in career and technical, and that's why I referenced it, where they are actually industry people who are the experts. And we're able to acquire a year-long certificate, and it can be renewed each year. Those Type M's do not have the provisions of tenure, but certainly it's the district that requests the Type M certificate to hire the best person for the job to teach the kids. And I see this bill working similarly.
Thank you. And so they are hired on a similar contract to certificated teachers?
That's correct, sir. It is generally the exact same contract, pay scale, and everything. It's just that they cannot acquire tenure.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Parma. We're going to go next to Jennifer Schmidt, also up in Matsu. Jennifer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Could you please state your name for the record, who you're with, and begin your testimony?
Absolutely. My name is Jennifer Schmidt, and I am the principal of Frontieris Spanish Immersion Charter School in the Matsu School District. And, I really thank Dr. Pearl for everything she said. I feel I don't even need to testify. Everything was pretty much spoken to. I do support this bill immensely. Being a principal for 4 years at Frontieris, I have run into difficulty every year, and I'm looking at another fall of difficulty. Finding sufficient candidates that speak the language and that are also certified. The Type M, the similar Type M, would really alleviate a lot of that. Right now, currently on staff, we have classified individuals who are wonderful, wonderful instructors. They are native Spanish speakers, have wonderful cultural experience and all the knowledge to share, but they do not hold a certificate, a teaching certificate, and therefore cannot be in the class, be the sole classroom teacher. So they work in different capacities. We have parents as well that are Spanish speakers, and again, are wonderful when they're working with our children, but they're not certified, and therefore we are unable to hire them. As our school grows, we continually need new teachers to join our team that are Spanish speakers, native Spanish speakers being our first desire, of course, And the pool is just very, very, very limited. We have to go out of state. We go out of country. We work with immigration attorneys, which is extremely expensive. And so this bill will allow us a different avenue, a different path to get the knowledgeable folks we need with the language that we're looking for. And it's going to help all future immersion charter schools and just immersion programs, regardless of which building they're in. The other thing to speak to with this bill, too, is the opportunity that could be given. I believe it's Section 8 that talks to the standardized testing in the target language. I think that is wonderful, especially for talking about the charter schools with the Alaska Native, the revitalization of their languages and just maintaining their language. That's something we look at, too, as we teach certain subject matters in the Spanish language 100%, but then the testing comes in English, and we've always been curious, how they would do. They do extremely well testing what they've learned in Spanish. They do very well testing it in English, but it would be nice to have that opportunity. So I love that that part has been added into Senate Bill 84. I've written a letter. I am happy to answer questions and things like that, but truly I just want to state just how excited I am that this bill is here, and I really urge everyone to think about it dearly and vote in favor of it. It's wonderful, and we have support from our district leadership, as you heard Dr. Paramo just moments ago. So I know this would just be such a benefit district-wide and hopefully statewide.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Any questions for Jennifer? Senator Gardner?
Thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony here. I'm looking at the sponsor's description of Section 8, and it says that it would require the Department of Education to allow students to take the standards-based assessment in the language of instructions of the school if tests comparable to the English language tests exist. Do you know if there are any in our state, for our tests, such tests exist in anything other than English right now?
Not with the high-stakes testing that we do, the Alaska Measurements of Progress. We are able to, it's been available to us in our school district, to test, to do some progress monitoring in Spanish. And our kindergarten and first grade, actually all the way second and third grade, I know that it's available in Spanish, our academic testing as well. But the third through 12th grade, the AMP testing that is done each spring, is not available, as far as I know, in our target language, which is Spanish.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions for Jennifer? Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Next, we have online Peggy Collins, superintendent of the North Slope Borough School District. Peggy, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much. As you indicated, Chairman and committee members, we appreciate your taking testimony. We also enthusiastically support Senate Bill 84, and we are interested in a few changes, and I'll note those. In Section 14.20.025, on page 4, line 19 of the version I'm looking at, this legislation recommends removing that the board may require a person issued a limited certificate to undertake academic training as may be required by the board by regulation make satisfactory progress. That is recommended to be removed. We find that a very valuable clause. We are just now beginning to implement it and actually use it in our district. Our current Type M's have, as was indicated by earlier speakers, have mastery of content area. But we are learning that they have not passed a teaching certificate program, and they sometimes need assistance in classroom management and best practices pedagogy. And so we are beginning to develop a sequence of courses and to assist them in taking those. And so we would like the board to be able to require teachers to take those in order to renew their Type M or their limited teacher certificate. in order to make sure that we get the best instruction. So we are against removing that. And similarly, where that repeats itself is on page 4, line 31, the C, because it says the board may not require. Similarly, on page 6, on line 11E, again, it repeats the board may not require. We'd like those to be changed to the board may require. So those are all the same change, but just done in multiple places because it repeats. The other recommendation we would like is that we wish that our teachers were fully fluent in their local indigenous knowledge. We are a place where our indigenous speakers are 80, 70, 60, and a few 50-year-olds. Most of them are getting to the retirement age, and their replacements are not fully fluent, but they are becoming fully fluent. And on page 5, line 27, it requires that they be able to conduct the language, their instruction entirely in the indigenous language. And we would like that to be gradiated in so that they could grow to be able to do it. If you go to page 7, where it says that the department will, that's what we'd like to do there. Another change is that we would like to be able to develop our own tests in our language. The amendment to the state testing section, we're on page 7, and it's section 1420.430, is about testing for language immersion educational programs. And it allows us to translate, allowing the translation of the statewide test. We'd also like to be able to develop, our own tests. And have them, considered legitimate tests. So again, we're supportive, but we would like, in order to be able to use and most benefit our students, we have those recommended changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Peggy. Any questions for Peggy Cowan? Senator Gardner?
Thank you. I'm not sure I completely understand what you mean by developing your own tests as opposed to a translation of the state assessments. Can you just help me clarify that?
Peggy?
Yes. Sorry. It's coming from a recommendation from our Inupiat Education Director, and so I am just... I don't think it is prohibited by this language, but we want to also develop our, besides translating the tests, the state tests, we're in the process of developing our own tests to test our own, cultural knowledge and language as well as the academics.
Senator?
Thank you. So you're not proposing that the students in your school, if you were to have a school under this statute, would be exempt from the state tests in either language. You're just talking about a test of cultural understanding as well as language as separate test?
Ms. Collin, could you hear the question? Ms. Collin, are you there?
Yeah,
based on
okay.
Our own criteria.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to test them on our own criteria, but so it's really another provision along with this.
Maybe, Peggy, you can get that on a piece of paper and send it down to the bill sponsor staff. Yeah. They can take a look at it.
We will.
Okay.
We'll write it up and send it some appropriate language.
Yeah, if you could write up all your thoughts on your recommendations and send them down, that would be great. Any additional questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Peggy. So in the audience here, do we have Lance Twitchell? Come on up, Lance, and state your name for the record, who you're with, and you can begin your testimony, please.
Yekeyuch Satinu, Chair Dunleavy and Honorable Committee Members. My name is Chone Lance Twitchell. I'm a professor of Alaska Native Languages at the University of Alaska Southeast, a delegate and tribal judge for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, a member of the Coalition of Native American Language Schools and Programs, though I am here representing only myself and my children who are speakers of our Tlingit language. I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 84 in hopes that we can move quickly and provide much needed and overdue assistance for Alaska languages with the passage of this bill. I'd like to say Gumishchish, thank you to Senator Olson and Jackie Boyer in Senator Olson's office and the office of Jonathan Christ Tompkins for working on this important piece of legislation. I feel that it is time to hold Alaskan education systems accountable for generations of failure to Alaska Native people, and that immersion schools will be a vital piece in a series of movements that will take us out of the dark age of language loss and cultural genocide and place the state of Alaska among the nation's leaders in indigenous language revitalization. Many of us are aware of the statistics. Anishinaabe language activist Margaret Norrie states, "Statistics show that American Indian and Alaska Native children have the highest death rate of any group of young people, the highest percentage of teens not in school, the highest percentage of children living in families where no parent has year-round employment, and the second highest percentage of children living in poverty. In addition, Alaska Native youth have the highest suicide rates and some of the lowest graduation rates in the country." Yuchi language activists Richard and Renee Grounds have noted, "Indigenous ways of knowing and learning are fundamentally devalued by the American school system. Throughout my English education process, I was told directly and indirectly that English is the only way to a successful life and that Yuchi simply does not count. This form of brainwashing is a carryover of a boarding school system that continually stressed that Native American languages are less important than English." Grounds and Grounds also note that many Native American children are not well equipped to handle these demeaning messages to their identity, and this prescribed and false sense of racial superiority and inferiority result in high rates of dropping out from school and committing suicide. To counter this narrative, we look to language immersion charter schools. We are living in an era where the status quo may very well result in a shift from 20 Alaska Native languages with speakers to less than 10 in the next decade. The continuous loss of languages will be accompanied by ever stable, if not increasing, rates of systemic failure. That failure is not owned by Alaska Native people, but by the entire state of Alaska and education systems of America. A 2000 study in Canada has shown that youth suicide rates effectively dropped to zero in those few communities in which at least half the band members reported a conversational knowledge of their own language. This is the dawn of effective change. Both Maori and Hawaiian languages have seen their communities go from handfuls of speakers to thousands of children who are fluent in their languages and performing at the highest levels ever recorded as a direct result of immersion charter schools. As Mohawk language warriors Margaret and Theodore Peters note, "Establishing immersion programs is the most crucial measure a community can execute if they are truly serious about saving even a portion of their languages through their children. The objective is to build our children's cultural identities through the acquisition of their inherent language." Alaska has members in the National Coalition of the Native American Language Schools and Programs. Some of the lead members of this group come from a Hawaiian language immersion charter school in Hilo. Hawaiian revitalization education began as an effort to reverse the near extermination of Hawaiian that accompanied federal English-only requirements imposed on Hawaii during the six decades of the territorial period. And now, Hawaii continues to have the largest enrollment of children in Native American language-based education. The total use of Hawaiian in their schools is seen as a playing a major role in producing among its students a strong association of Native Hawaiian identity with high academic achievement, and has produced 14 years of 100% high school graduation and 80% college attendance, where students function well in English medium universities.
Lance, would you be able to wrap up shortly?
Yes, I've just got three okay. short paragraphs there. The state of Alaska is already a leader in language revitalization, but there is much work to be done. The Native Languages Act of 1991 mandated that attention be paid to the problem of dying, or in many cases already extinct, languages. This bill opens the door further and brings attention to a situation that is dire, but completely fixable. It is time to elevate language immersion charter schools as the ideal forms of education in Alaska. This bill will not require additional resources, but will open the door for many of these schools. These schools will be capable of accessing additional funding through agencies like the Administration for Native Americans, the National Science Foundation, and other agencies and entities that support language revitalization in America. We don't have to see the statistics on educational failure and language loss any longer. We are standing at the edge of that failure and loss. The future of our children is brighter than it is now, and the key is teaching through our languages. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Lance? Seeing none, we're going to put the bill off the side. I want to thank Ms. Breuer for her work on this. You did very good on your first presentation. I want to thank her, Senator Wilson. I want to thank Mr. Mangdans back there, who I know is helping on the House side of things with Representative Tompkins. And this is a bill that will, I think, garner much discussion as we get on the road here. So with that, we're going to take just a quick break to transition out. In session. Next, we're going to go to a bill that's going to be introduced. This bill is Senate Bill 102. It's a bill introduced by myself, Senator Dunleavy. We have Sheila Peterson, staff to myself, who's going to introduce the bill. We'll give an overview. This is a bill that when we're done with it today, we'll set it off to the side and pick it up at the next hearing. I know we're running out of time in the year here. But with that, Sheila, do you want to just give a brief introduction, and then I'll add a few words to the bill. Please identify yourself for the record. Do you got that microphone close enough? Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy, my name is Sheila Peterson, staff to Senator Dunleavy. The bill before you is Senate Bill 102, is a collaborative effort between many people in many school districts. For many years, the school districts have expressed concerns about unfunded mandates put on by both the state and federal government. This is a response to their plea for some relief. I'd like to just walk through the sectional analysis and look at section 1 through 3. These sections pertain to a bill that we passed last year that would allow students to demonstrate mastery by challenging the course. The legislation last year gave the school districts a year to implement this and will become effective July 1st, 2015. But during that year, some of the school districts raised concern. And Section 1 defines the term secondary school and limits it to 9 through 12. Section 2 says that all the courses that are offered in math, language arts, science, social studies, and world histories that's offered by the school district do not have to have a mastery test for all courses. They can choose which courses in those core areas that they would like to offer a challenging course. And the third section asks the Department of Education to look at off-the-shelf, ready-made assessment tools and make recommendations to the districts on what challenging tests they could use.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator, I'm sorry. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Would you prefer me to ask questions after you go all the way through, or as they come up? Okay. It's interesting how you describe Section 3 about offering to look at the assessment tools a district may use, as opposed to a list of organizations that provide tools, because I was going to ask, why not just have a list of approved assessment tools? Because an organization might provide some really good assessment tools and some poor assessment tools. But the language actually says to approve a list of organizations, not tools.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, you're right. The drafter did use the word organization, and maybe we might wish to look at that to see if there would be a better term to use. But the intent is that the school districts would not have to independently research what assessment tools are the best, nor would they have to create their own assessment tool, that they could use one that has been professionally designed and would show a mastery in the course that it was testing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Section 4 may be actually drafted incorrectly as well. The intent behind Section 4 is to ask the Department of Education to place on the web a document that they have prepared that provides all the information on determining the foundation formula and school funding for each district. It's fondly known as the five-pager. It has all the information that anyone would like to know that goes into coming up with the state aid for the school districts. The intent was that the Department of Education would put this five-pager on the web for everyone to review and to be able to sort if they wished.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. So this is a document that already exists, and the only thing this is doing is asking that it be put up for to be publicly available?
That is the intent. It has been misconstrued, I guess, because of the drafting style, that it was something more elaborate than that. But that's the intent, and we've been working with the drafter to come up with a simpler way of explaining it, and I think we've achieved that.
Thank you.
Section 5 requires the State Board of Education to look at when they adopt or amend or repeal a regulation, what the effect would have on local school districts. Currently, the department, when they amend or repeal or promulgate a regulation, may not look explicitly at each look at school districts and what the potential cost would that be. And this would be an advisory note that would attach to the regulations. Section 6, 7, and 8 deal with REA school boards, city and borough school boards, and the State Board of Education for Mount Edgecombe to establish a procedure to provide a schedule for training. It lists a variety of training courses that will be held, could be held every 5 years on a staggered rate. It could be held more frequent if, in fact, the personnel in the school districts changed, and so they reached a point where the school boards had decided that they need to be trained. The training programs that are listed throughout Senate Bill 102 deal with the discrimination in textbooks and instructional materials. It deals with training for employee evaluation. It deals with alcohol and drug-related issues. It deals with school crisis response and crisis intervention with restraint and seclusion, with domestic violence and sexual assault, and mandatory reporting of child abuse or neglect. These various training programs throughout the statute have been added hit and miss, and so there's no cohesive schedule for training. And throughout the bill, this will say that you can train them every 5 years based on a staggered system, and earlier if you wish.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Huggins and then Senator Gardner.
Yeah, thank you. So you read off four or five categories of school districts. Which ones aren't included?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Huggins, the intent was to catch all training programs.
Okay, that's good. That's fine. That's good.
There is one that is not included because it sunsets in 2016, and that is suicide prevention. So when that training program next year is discussed, it is hoped that if they decide to put it back in as a requirement, that it would also go be put back in under a staggered five-year schedule.
Senator, so let me re-ask my question. What I was talking about was a description of the school districts. You described multiple school districts, city school districts. My question is, are there school districts that weren't included that you were describing?
REAs, municipalities, boroughs. Go ahead.
Senator Dunleavy and Senator Huggins, I think that's it.
Okay.
You've got your school, you've got your REAs, you've got your city and rural school districts, and the State Board of Education.
Senator is just concerned if we left any out, if there were, we just identify those types of school districts we left out, but I believe you covered them. Senator Gardner?
Thank you. The five-year cycle, I know that is the training requirement for mandated reporters of child abuse. Is that how you reach that, or is there some other thinking that it would be a five-year? I mean, why not 3 years or 6 years?
Senator Gardner, this 5 years was recommended by a variety of educational organizations, and it seemed reasonable, and so that's where we got the 5 years.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
And Mr. Chairman, I think you indicated that the district, if they found it was more important to do like something like assault or child abuse more than, often than that, they would have certainly be up to them.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, yes, that is correct. If a school had a 30% turnover in their personnel, they may wish to design that in their procedure, that they're at a certain point they felt that that training was needed, that the training would be taken care of. This would allow the flexibility at the local school districts to make the decision on within those 5 years when the training should occur.
Please continue.
And Section 9 and 10 also is a conforming statement that says that school districts dealing with discriminatory textbook and educational materials, as well as the training for evaluation of certified teachers, they too should be involved in this five-year period. As they work through this bill, depending on how the drafting was for the particular training sessions, it means when they're included. Section 11 is a section that does not deal with training, but it deals with a school district implementing a layoff procedure of when they could lay off a tenured teacher. Currently, a plan to lay off tenured teacher is because the school attendance of the school district decreased, or the basic need of the school district decreased 3%. So you needed to have both of those issues take place before you could implement a layoff program for tenured teachers. situation has come where the school district at school attendance is not decreasing but is increasing, and their basic need is not decreased by 3%. But yet the funding may be going down, or the availability of some of the dollars are not there. And so sometimes they feel that they would need to have, would like to have some more flexibility. And that's what this change does. It allows them that flexibility.
Senator.
So that flexibility really is about when a district needs to lay off tenured teacher because there's not enough funding to retain them? Or is this something slightly different?
Senator Dunleavy and Senator Gardner, this came from one school district that expressed concern that they needed the flexibility. I don't know the specific example as far as what the funding level is, but it must, the basic need as determined by the Department of Education was not the 3%. And so they were unable to implement the layoff plan that the school board had in, had put in place.
Please continue.
Can you tell me the name of that school district?
Senator sure. Donnelly, through the chair, it would be the Mat-Su School District.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Section 12, 13, and 14 also deal with the flexibility of the training. Section 12 deals with alcohol and drug-related disabilities. Section 13 deals with school crisis response. Section 14 deals with the domestic violence. Section 15 of the bill deals with statutes and fiscal notes. That if a bill coming through the legislature impacts local school districts, the department would make a good faith effort to estimate the cost that this might be, what that cost might be on each individual school district. It is anticipated that this provision was in place maybe 20 years ago, and during that, at that time, the school districts would reach out to the various educational organizations to help them devise a fiscal note. It was an advisory fiscal note, but it did give the legislators an opportunity to use that information when judging the value of the piece of legislation that was going through. Section 16.
You have a question, Senator? I'm sorry, Sheila. Senator?
I think I've got it. Thank you.
Please continue.
Section 16 is a conforming section dealing with adopting regulations and having a fiscal note. Section 17 is another training conforming section dealing with child abuse as a mandatory reporter. And Section 18 is a repealer of what is commonly known as the 70-30 provision. This is a provision that was put in place in 1998 that required that 70% of the instructional dollars given through state aid, or state aid, 70% of the state aid dollars would be used for instruction. Set in place a waiver provision that if a district could not get 70% of their funds allocated to instruction, that they came before the Department of Education and asked for a waiver. It has been determined by the school districts and at times others that it has accomplished its goal. It encouraged and required people to put money into instruction. However, the structure of our system, and currently there are some school districts that are unable to make the 70% annually. And so it may be an effort of trying very hard to get 70% into the instruction, cannot make it, and therefore have to ask for a waiver.
Questions, Senator Stevens?
Chairman, probably no surprise that I'm very concerned about that clause. This happened in 1998 before I got here in 2000, and I think it's a good goal. You know, there were so many, as I remember before I came down here as a school board president and just a citizen, that there were such horror stories of superintendents who made an enormous amount of money for a small district way out nowhere, and the money never got to the student. It never got to the classroom. It never got to the instruction. So to say that 70% of the funds should go to instruction and 30% and only 30% to the administration seems to be a reasonable thing to expect of a district. What are we going to say? You can do 30% instruction and 70% administration? I think anybody would just rise up in anger if that were the case in a district. So I'm really concerned about changing this. I think the waiver, I know it's troublesome to some districts, but so what? We can expect when we send money to a district that their job is to instruct kids, not to have a first-class administration and no instruction. You know, so I would have a serious problem accepting this. It just doesn't seem, it seems like it's going in the wrong direction. It's saying the goals that we have established are not as valuable now as they were then. They're still valuable to instruct kids, to get the money in the classroom, not to put the money into administration.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, I'm sure that the Department of Education will be able to address some of your concerns, but I believe that most of the people at school districts that request a waiver, it is because of their cost on fuel and cost of maintenance of buildings. Those two figures seem to stick out.
Could I ask a representative of the department to come up that may be able to answer a question around this issue? Don't all volunteer at once. And please identify yourself for the record, and I'm going to ask a question. I'll turn it over to the committee to ask questions based upon Senator Stevens' concerns.
Thank you. For the record, Elizabeth Needleman, Director of School Finance and Facilities.
Thank you. Question, on the 70-30, in the 70%, what are the components in there? Is a superintendent's salary put into that 70% as well for instruction?
Chair Dunleavy, the 70% does not include the superintendent's salary. What's included in the 70%, the calculation is broke out by placing about five categories that are termed broadly as instruction in the 70%, and then about three categories in non-instruction. So your classroom teachers, your library services, your principals and your support services are instruction. Your superintendent's office, your business office, your operations and maintenance, including heating oil, and your student activities are non-instruction.
Okay. So if you had a rural school district, for example, and are most of your school districts that apply for a waiver, are most of them rural?
Chair Dunleavy, many of them would be rural, yes.
Are there any that are non-rural? And I don't mean REAs, I mean it could be a borough school district, city school district, but rural meaning off the road in your more expensive areas of the state.
Chair Dunleavy, there is a somewhat combination. Yes, there are definitely districts that have a road system and are not necessarily rural. Over the years, we've identified two categories of districts that often request a waiver, and one is districts with smaller budget than our, say, our five largest districts. And the other is districts that maybe what's referred to as rural with high operations and maintenance like fuel.
So there was a concern raised, and then I'm going to open up to the board and the committee. There was a concern raised that the 70-30 was a tool to hem folks in so that they directed most of the funding towards instruction. Can you give us an appraisal of what the department thinks of that over the years, and
Has there been any instances where a district has been denied a waiver? And if so, what was the nature of that denial?
Chair Dunleavy, the waivers go to the state board, and the requirement is that the district submits a letter to the state board telling the state board what the items were that kept them from meeting the 70%. And of those waivers, over the years, they have not been denied. Zero waivers have been denied. There has been conversation back to the districts, and districts have been asked to explain expenditures outside of instruction. And so conversations have been had, and understandings have been come to about where the funds would go. But to answer your question, none have been denied.
Senator Stevens.
I guess my concern, Mr. Levin, is if we get rid of this 70-30 split, 70 instruction, 30% administration, if we get rid of it, then what controls are there that the department has over misuse of funds, over lots of plane trips by the superintendent, high salaries by the superintendent, and what control would you have if this disappears?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, you know, in a local control state, those decisions are made at the local level. This simply provides an opportunity once a year where the state board hears from those districts that are not spending 70% of the operating budget in instruction.
Thank you.
Questions? Good question. Very good question. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. I vaguely remember when we were going through all this, but on the other end of it, I think the five largest school districts, probably upwards of 90%, is spent on salaries and benefits. Is that anywhere close?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Huggins. Right. I think that has been a reference number.
Yeah. So while we're telling war stories, the one I remember the most vividly was ADAC. I think we had the superintendent work for about 4 or 5 years after the school district had closed down. It was gone. There weren't any students there at all. We just kept working. We just paid them.
And a very good salary.
Yeah, and a huge salary.
Just for the record, that wasn't me.
Anyway, that's my war story. And Elizabeth, I know you weren't born by that time, but that's okay. Anyway, that's my war story for the day.
A very good question. That's why we're rolling the ball to be vetted for people to ask questions. I know that when I did spend time in rural Alaska, which was about 20 years, one of the interesting things that we had to do that they didn't have to do in urban Alaska is we had to use our instructional dollars to build teacher housing. So in Anchorage, for example, just using that as an example, if you were given a dollar, you could use as much of that towards instruction as possible. But in for example, Northwest Arch, Bering Straits, a whole bunch of rural school districts that did not have the infrastructure in place for teacher housing, we had to use that dollar for housing, which didn't necessarily go towards the 70-30 per se. And then our maintenance costs, the ability to replace a window, let's say in Kotzebue, as opposed to Anchorage, which was much greater. Certainly, I'm not making excuses. I'm merely pointing out that there were some issues embedded within that are causing, I believe, and I could be wrong, and Elizabeth, if I am, please correct me, that these may be some of the reasons why rural school districts have asked for waivers. But I think generally in the past 10 years, it's been fuel, energy, maintenance issues out there per se. When they ask for a waiver, do they have to open up their books to some extent for you and the board to look at to say, you know what, your board travel is out of whack here, your superintendent salaries are out of whack here, or something along the lines that Senator Stevens is raising? Does that happen?
Chair Dunleavy, even without the requirement for the waiver, the department has a statutory requirement to review the operating budgets. to see that they're in form, that they're compliant, that the revenues are correct, that the expenditures are correct. And as we go through that process, we do review the operating budgets each year for reasonableness. In addition to that, if a waiver is requested, we look to see if the reasons the district gives for the waivers are reflected in the dollars as the budget was drafted. So if someone were to say that their heating costs were high and that's why they were unable to meet the 70%, we would look to see if, in fact, the heating costs were high. If somebody said their heating costs were high and they were the second lowest heating costs in the state, then we would say, we need to talk about this. That doesn't really look like that was the reason. We review all operating funds, and when the waivers come in, we review for the reasons and causes that are put forth in support of that waiver.
Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, maybe there's another way to do this. I think if your goal is to ease up the pressure on the really small districts that always are going to have out of whack, spending more on fuel oil, for example, maybe there can be three categories: instruction, administration, and operating costs. Or maybe we can find another way to look at it, because it does seem like when you say there have been all these waivers, but none have been denied, it sounds to me like they're doing the job they should be doing, and maybe we're asking a lot of work on their part to try and justify it. Now, that I don't know. I'm just taking a wild guess. And so maybe, just a thought, take fuel oil out of the equation if that's the biggest problem we have.
Good idea, seriously. And does the department have a position on this section of the bill that we're discussing right now?
As Senator Dunleavy, I did not. I do not answer that question because I haven't checked. So I would ask Deputy Commissioner Les Morris if he just wanted to.
Deputy Commissioner, can you please identify yourself for the record? The question was, does the department have a position, at least on this section of the bill, the 70-30 rule, as we call it?
For the record, Les Morris, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Education. The board actually took a position a number of years ago and asked for it to be repealed. But then about a year and a half ago, that board took action to repeal their waiver or repeal their resolution to remove this. And the reason was, as they dug into a couple of school districts, in particular one school district, they learned more about the process of what the department does, and they saw some value in that. So the department's had different positions over time over this. The board's latest action was simply that they found, well, let me back up one more. The board previously took the action because they found they were doing waivers for the very same districts every single year, and that there was very consistent reasons for that, which Ms. Noodleman already reviewed. And but the board, as they dug into it, saw a value in the discussion and the dialogue and the work that went on between the department and the districts, and that's why they took their action. Beyond that, the department hasn't really taken a position on this particular issue. We'd be happy to dialogue more about it, and the board is actually in June having opportunities for some discussion, and I don't know where they stand. This board looks a little bit different than the board that was there even a year and a half ago.
So I appreciate that. And the purpose of this bill is a tool. It's not an issue that I've been dreaming about forever. It's come as a result of discussions with school districts, because, you know, it really said again when we were first talking about a bill that Senator Gardner introduced, commonly referred to as Aaron's Law, and in school districts, figuratively speaking, let out a moan that there was another straw being put on the camel's back, and that started a dialogue with school districts. One analogy, and I'll be brief, one analogy that I've used, because somebody's kind of put me on to, they said, it's like public education is like a meal. where everybody that's a stakeholder gets to walk in line and put their ingredient in the pot. Somebody put a pizza in the pot, somebody put a pair of shoes in the pot, somebody put a hamburger in the pot, a fish in the pot, chocolate milk in the pot. There's no denying that it's a soup. And we all have our fingerprints on it. But when somebody takes a bite of it, they go, oh God, this is not what we, you know, this is not what we thought it would be. So what we're trying to, at least I'm trying to figure out through this helping school districts is getting their feedback as to what are some things we can take off their plates, which may seem, we may not be aware of because this has been a this has been something that's grown over the years, actually the decades. We come up with good ideas in the House and the Senate and the governor does, and Congress does, and Secretary of State, our Secretary of Education Duncan does, and school boards do, and ASBs, advisor school boards do, and that all adds to the soup. So what we're trying to figure out is what are some things that are no longer needed, maybe redundant, can be done differently to free up a little bit of breathing room for the school districts, because we seem to be, there seems to be something new every year that we have to do for, sometimes they say two, school districts in order for things to get better. But again, I'm hearing more and more folks saying, there's no more time in the day, there's no funding, there's no staff capacity. Can you help us out? Can you stop loving us to death, basically? So that was the idea. And 7030 was put in there. I think Senator Stevens' concerns are very legitimate. So what we would ask is, as we go through the bill, we look at the bill, a dialogue maybe take place within the department saying, how can we make this, do we really need this? Does it do what it's supposed to do? And if there is, if there's still legitimate concerns, can we modify it so it lessens the impact on districts, especially small districts? I had one individual call me and says, you know, I'm the superintendent. I said, yes. I said, you know, I'm also the director of special ed. I'm the main finance person. I'm this, I'm that, et cetera, et cetera. And any little thing you can take off, that means that's time that I don't have to sit here in the office and can go in the classroom. You know the whole story. You know the stories. But what we're going to try and do is find a balance between the purpose of the original purpose of the bill, what has happened since then, and how can we help these school districts build capacity to be in the classroom, to deal with kids, to teach kids, as opposed to dealing with paperwork? Is that, well, that's basically what the purpose of the bill is. Question?
So after your high-level appeal, I have one down in the weeds question relating to the 70-30 issue. So, and we did talk with school districts about this when we were working on the Aaron's Law. You review the operating costs annually with or without a 70-30 waiver request. So what we heard from districts is that the process or the record keeping to do the waiver request was onerous, and they wanted some relief from that. So what part of the application process would go away if they still have to do all the accounting pieces for you?
So through the chair, Senator Gardner, the piece that would go away is they would not have to write a letter to the state board once a year explaining what types of expenditures are high outside the classroom that put them below the 70%. And so they would not have to send that to the department. Maybe get a call from the department if we need to provide for some clarification. And then, you know, they would want to follow that process, and it goes to the state board. There's a state board meeting. They may want to listen in. So it's their letter explaining why they're below 70%. And
all the bookkeeping and stuff would go on exactly the same. They would just have to ask and defend the ask.
Correct.
Thank you.
So we got about 4 minutes left, and we have folks that want to testify publicly, and I'm not sure if we're going to get to them. We may have to try and I'll talk with the committee here later to see if schedules will permit one last meeting on this. But I do have a question. There was a fiscal note prepared. The fiscal notes in the neighborhood of $1.2 million. And I guess the question I would have is, when the mandates that we're talking about in this bill were first developed and then implemented, was there an associated fiscal note that went to the school district's additional funding to actually implement these mandates? Or was there not? And if there was not, why now is there a cost to these mandates, but there wasn't a cost to the districts when they were doing them?
Again, for the record, Elizabeth Needleman, Director of School Finance, and Chair Dunleavy, the fiscal note is related to Section 4, and it's related to the language around Section 4 that I believe is related to the department, not to an unfunded mandate at a district level. But it's around the language of providing a tool on the website with raw data and formulas to manipulate and estimate the foundation program funding. And I think that I would differentiate between providing a report that reports out in great detail, and Sheila referred to that as the five-pager. It has ADM, adjusted ADM, it has every factor, it shows each factor with the adjusted ADM increasing, it shows things such as full values, required minimum local, but it's simply a report. If you are requesting a tool that can be used as a live calculating tool on the website for the foundation program, that is not currently available at the department. We have a multitude of work papers in a really just an old system that we use to calculate the foundation program. And so if a sortable report is what is asked for, then that would be a different matter. If we're asking, if we're being asked for a tool with data and formulas that can be manipulated on the website, then that is a task.
Okay. Again, Les Morse, Deputy Commissioner, I just wanted to indicate there's two fiscal notes because there's ones that come from two different divisions. So I don't know if you just had questions about the one fiscal note or if you had any questions regarding the other as well.
I was facetiously, I said before the meeting started to Senator Stevens that this was a small bill, but I'm sure we'll just get on through with no questions. But in reality, I understand that it's a bill that requires us to have conversation so we're all on the same page. And I think that's part of what this dialogue we hope to do is that we, the Senate and hopefully the House, the governor, the department, the school districts, the various associations associated with school districts, we all start together on the same page and start to come up this maybe with some common agreements as to what is necessary, what is not. What costs money? Because we've heard conversations coming from superintendents and others saying, this is going to cost us money. And we've had conversations, for example, with the department on maybe the same issue that says, well, I don't see, maybe not, maybe it won't cost money. So just trying to get on the same page, I think, is going to get us going in the right direction, which I think will reduce costs and will streamline things and give school districts some of the breathing room that they need. But I think this bill is a very good conversation piece to begin that process in earnest. And I would say that once we get this going, it's just my thought that I think you might see a bill like this every year that repeals or at least questions some of the things that we're doing. It's a healthy question. For example, I know that in statute right now, I forget what it is, 14, AS-14, whatever. We have a law in the books that says, we have to pay attention to environmental education. This law was put into the books in the 90s. I don't know if you're aware of that. It's on the books. Do we do it? I don't know. Should we do it? I don't know. It's those things when you're a school practitioner, you're looking at all these regs, all these mandates, and when we create them at the state level through legislation or regulation, sometimes we move on to something else that's important, but they're still saddled with having to see these things through. So that's all. It's a conversation piece. I apologize to the people online that want to testify. I'm going to talk with the committee after the meeting here and see what schedules are like. We're getting towards the end of the session. I'm trying to be realistic, and this is a bill that's going to need conversation, and most likely the conversations will take place over the summer. I'm going to be asking the committee if we can meet periodically, because I think education is going to be a huge issue. It is for everybody, and with our budgetary issues going on, I want to be able to give education the fair shake and the due attention that it deserves. And given what we're dealing with here, the magnitude of the free fall in revenue, et cetera, and things coming down from Washington, I think we're going to be meeting a few times this summer. We can talk about schedules and so forth, but we're not going to have time today to finish up and talk with or get more folks online to testify. So with that, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. I appreciate everyone coming. I appreciate everyone listening to the introduction of the bill. Our staff will talk with your staff to see if there's any other time this week for us to meet to hear some more of this bill. Okay. So, again, thank you, everybody, and the meeting is adjourned.